A story of the Irish diaspora today on the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Journalist Cole Morton is our guest. Morton is the author of Hungry for Home, Leaving the Blaskets, A Journey from the Edge of Ireland. Hungry for Home is about the abandonment of the Great Blasket, an island off the west coast of Ireland. Many of the residents of the island emigrated to the U.S. In particular, the book tells the story of the Kearney family and how they uprooted themselves and moved away from an ancient way of life. Cole Morton is a Londoner. He was born in East London in 1967. He writes for the Independent newspaper and other publications. Hungry for Home is his first book. It's published by Viking. Listeners, I invite your questions for our guest this afternoon, Cole Morton. Here are the telephone numbers. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else you're listening, join us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Cole Morton, good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Celeste. Thank you.
The island, the Great Blasket, was abandoned in 1953, sometime before you were born. How did you come to learn the island's story?
Well, as ever, a woman is to blame. I went to that part of the world, to the end of the Dingle Peninsula, which is, I suppose, as far west as you can get in Europe without falling off the end, when I was 16, and fell in love there. And that didn't last very long, but what did last much longer was a feeling for the place and for the people and for the scenery there, and a feeling that there was something I wanted to explore. As it happens, I didn't go back for a very long time. But when I did go back, I went back in search of a feeling of being at home. I didn't find it, but what I did find was this extraordinary story. I simply one day took a coach as far west as I could and stood looking out at the sea and saw an abandoned island and began to wonder where everybody had gone.
Yeah. On my desk, I have a reference book. It's a dictionary of geography. Mm. And it's a pretty good book. I mean, it's pretty thorough. But there is no entry for the Blasket Islands, nor for the Great Blasket. Are the islands and their history known in Ireland?
Oh, in Ireland, the people who lived on the Great Blasket were taken up as being symbolic in some ways of the way that Ireland could reinvent itself after it became an independent nation. They were a community of people who essentially lived without a leader, who spoke a form of Gaelic which had not been heard on the mainland for 200 or 300 years, who lived very simple, very straightforward lives. And in some ways, they were idealized by Irish politicians and became central to the whole project of reinventing Ireland. So in Ireland itself, the Blasket name is universally known. Almost everybody who read Irish at school had to read one or other of the Blasket books. And I know from correspondence I've had with people in the States that even there among the Irish community, the name of the Blaskets is universally known. But it is true that we're talking about a small group of islands. The Great Blasket is about 3/4 of a mile by about 3 miles, right at the edge of things, on the tip of Europe, as I said. So they're not, in terms of land mass, they're not significant, but in terms of the culture of Ireland and its diaspora, they've been hugely significant.
Yeah. And in Britain, is this story known?
No.
I
mean, there's one of the themes, sort of subtext of the book, really, is the ambivalent relationship between England and Ireland. And, of course, as an Englishman going to the west of Ireland and hearing aspects of history that I knew nothing of, that was an education. Mm. But essentially, in England, no, people have barely heard of the Great Blasket. But what there is, of course, and I think this is the case all over the world, is that there's a fascination with people who have made their lives in remote places, castaways, if you like, or you know, survivors.
Yeah. Some of my family comes from the west of Ireland, and I'm unfamiliar with the Blaskets, and now you've made me hungry for seeking out the literature of the island.
Well, there's a lot of it.
Tell us about these books that came from the island and how they helped spread the story of the Blaskets on the mainland of Ireland.
Right. Well, if you can imagine around 1900, there were about 120 people living on this island, in a tiny village, really, on the edge of a mountain, you might call it, in the middle of the sea. And their way of life was very much, you could call it a medieval Gaelic way of life. It was the way people had lived before centuries of invasion and oppression, essentially. And so they told that the main form of recreation was to tell stories around the fire late at night. And some of the stories they told can be traced back to the trading route that used to exist in classical times between the west of Ireland and the Mediterranean. And some of those stories, which are told as if they happened yesterday, have parallels with Greek and Roman myth. So they were a people who had a strong sense of language, a strong sense of cultural identity, and who told each other stories all the time to make sense of the world around them, to make sense of their own history. And it was their way of understanding things. When people who were looking to reinvent Ireland, to rediscover the Irish language, to help it reclaim its pride in itself, heard about this community, they began to go there to listen, to learn this unique form of Irish, and to try to understand the community and send word of it to the outside world. So that the first person to do that was the playwright J.M. Singh, who wrote The Playboy of the Western World, his most famous work. He went there in 1904, 1905, and he went in, heard the stories, went away and wrote about it. And other scholars came after him in the 10, 15, 20 years after him. Gaelic scholars came in to learn the language and to study the culture. And of course, the inevitable happened. As people came in from the outside world and wanted to hear the stories of the island, there was an exchange of information. So news of the outside world, if you like, beyond the Dingle Peninsula, got into the island. And finally, what happened was that one of the scholars who came gave a book to an island man called Tomáš Criden, a book of Maxim Gorky's, and said, here is a book in which Russian peasants are described and their way of life is described, and if that can make a book, why can't your lives? And essentially what happened then was that two of the great island storytellers allowed their stories and their reflections to be dictated, dictated them and allowed them to be taken down and turned into book form. So that was Tomáš Criden, who wrote a book called The Island Man. The other one was Peg Sayers, who was a female storyteller, in some ways the matriarch of the island, who wrote a biography. And then Maurice O'Sullivan, who was a younger man, who actually moved to the mainland, wrote about the experience of leaving the island and moving to the mainland. And that became a book called 20 Years of Growing, which many more people are familiar with because it was a big hit in America. It was the Book of the Month Club's book back in the 30s.
Interesting. Well, give us some idea of the stories that the islanders told.
Well, there are all sorts. My favorite, actually, is a religious one. The religion on the island was Catholic, certainly, but it was not like the establishment Catholic faith on the mainland. It was slightly more, I suppose these days we characterize it as slightly more pagan, slightly more pantheistic, more in touch with the natural world around it. And they told, as I say, they told stories of origin. So one of the stories of origin was how come the hen finds it so hard to lay eggs, but the pig, the sow, finds it really easy to have piglets. And the start of this story, which I love, is when our Lord was on the run from the police. Now, you could write a book just about that one phrase, I think, what the history of that was. But essentially, Christ was on the run from the police and hid in a hole, and a hen came and clucked over his head and alerted people to where he was, and he gets up and runs away and curses the hen, and then a sow is digging a hole and allows him to creep under her and be hidden, and she was therefore blessed with having pigs, piglets easily. So, I mean, that's just one example of a mixture of different ideas. There's an anti-establishment idea, there's an idea of rebellion, and of course they were under distant English rule at the time that story became popular. And there's also a profound sense of the reaction between the divine and the natural.
Yeah. These stories, there was a great interest in them for a time, and you mentioned the books that were written, and that one of them was a bestseller and was a Book of the Month Club selection some time back. But I'm wondering, have the stories of the island survived among the island's descendants on the mainland and in America, the children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren?
You mean, do they have the habit of telling
them? Yeah.
Not really.
Yeah.
I think that's what happens when you take an oral culture and write it down. The stories that Peg and Tamash and the others told were essentially fluid. You know, they improvised them. They had core truths in them, but they changed every day. Once you put them down on paper, you make them into something else. You turn them into artifacts, make them sacred somehow. So people, the stories have carried on through the books, if you like, but they've been frozen in time, really. And one of my intentions with Hungry for Home was to explore the different ways in which people from the island have kept telling stories, but the stories they've told have been about their origins, how they came to leave, what it was like in the last days, and what they're going to do with their lives. So they've carried on being storytellers, but the nature of their stories has changed.
Hmm. How was it that people came to live on the Great Blasket? Who were the ancestors of the people living there in the 20th century?
Well, in all of the history of this, I have to wear my nationality as an Englishman with some caution, I have to say, because most of the islanders had been driven there in the search for a decent way of life, having been either evicted or treated badly by absentee English landlords in the west of Ireland. So we know that there were people living on the Great Blasket in the 1800s. It's thought that there were people living there at the time of the Spanish Armada in the 1580s, because there are reports from captains in the Spanish Armada that they have seen natives there. But then again, the report said that they were Spanish-speaking natives, so you can't trust that entirely. But as far as we know, sometime between the 1500s and the 1800s, people began to go to the edge and look out at the islands and think that, in some ways, a way of life could be possible there that was free of the control, really, of people on the mainland. So, historically, it had been a place for Celtic monks to go in search of peace and solitude and to go and try to find God. But much later, it became a place for people just to try and find a decent place to live, really.
Yeah, but the landscape is quite harsh.
Very harsh, yeah. But one of the things you notice when you first go to the end of the Dingle Peninsula is that the field markings are tremendously high up on the mountain. I characterize them in the book as if they were the scratchings left by a man who's drowning. Because as the dreadful famine times took hold in the mid-1800s in Ireland, people went further and further west and tried to farm more and more inhospitable land, just for the sake of getting something to eat. And that actually drove a lot more people onto the Great Blasket, where it was said that the famine never killed anybody. But there are other reasons for that, which are rather entertaining ones, which I mentioned in the book.
Right. The people on the island saw hardship, certainly, and hunger, and there were apparently some deaths during the Great Famine. But by and large, they survived and then thrived. How were they able to get through those years, 1845, 1849?
Well, there's two lovely stories, really. One of them involves a missionary who was paid for with money coming out of London from the Irish Missionary Society, whose name was Jordan, who went to the island and said, well, okay, if you allow your children, if the head of the household converts, I'll allow the children to be fed the corn that I've had imported. And his annual reports show that pretty soon everybody on the island had converted. And then, unaccountably, in the middle of the famine years, I think 1848, something like that, unaccountably, his annual reports back to London suddenly say that everybody's converted back again, and that nobody wants the corn anymore, and that all the work he'd done was falling apart around him. And the reason for that, and I don't think this connection had been made until I wrote the book, was that there were two shipwrecks that came close to the island. And basically everything that the islanders needed to protect them from the famine, in terms of supplies, things they could sell, and food were washed up on the shore from the shipwrecks, and suddenly they all converted back to the faith that they'd had before the missionary arrived. So they got through it that way. And, of course, the other thing is, they were surrounded by sea, and they were expert fishermen, so there were other ways for them to survive, too.
Oh. So meanwhile, though, the famine, it just to think of this, you write that the famine's mark can still be seen in the west of the mainland, in Dunquin, through emigration and depletion in the population and death and emigration, the mark is still very much on the island of the larger island of Ireland.
Yeah. In the valley where I stayed to research and write the book, and where some of the Blasket Islanders still live, there was at one time a population of something approaching 2,000. Now in the winter you're lucky if it's 150, much less than that probably. Those people didn't all leave. A lot of them died. And a lot of the remains of what the villages were like before they died can still be seen very clearly. This is a part of the world where the field markings and the villages and the way that particular farms are marked out have been pretty much the same for 400, 500, 600 years. So you can read the history there in the field. And from that point of view, it's a fairly harrowing place to be if you know the history. I'll never forget the evening that a local school teacher, Michal Delaney, drove me around the valley and told me of the various different townships there had been in the valley before the famine, and that, you know, there were 100 people living here and 200 people living there. And as we drove around, there was nobody there at all, just empty fields and old houses. It's quite a haunting thing to do.
Mm. As an Englishman, how were you received?
Surprisingly well. I say surprising because I was surprised. There's a reason for it, though. I think if I've been writing about other communities on the west coast of Ireland, there might have been a different reception. But, you know, I told you, Celeste, about the different scholars who'd come and studied the language and studied the community and had helped to promote the idea of the community. Well, a number of them, most notably a guy called Robin Flower and another called George Thompson, were Englishmen, and they were friends of the island, and they were people who took great pains to understand its culture and to live among the people and learn their language. And they are thought of very highly by Blasket Islanders and their survivors. Robin Flower wrote a wonderful book called The Western Islands, which I'd recommend to anybody who is just thinking of this story, after mine, of course. essentially, there was a history of well-meaning, thoughtful Englishmen going there and trying to understand and coming to grips with the culture. So, in that sense, the way had been prepared for me. It was difficult. It took the best part of 5 years, really, getting to know people and getting to know the language and visiting over and over again to be trusted somehow.
Yeah.
But it did work. And in fact, one of the proudest moments really of last year for me was when we launched the book down in Dunquin, and one by one the people from the island who were there came up and said, you know, this is how it was for us. This represents our community. And I was so moved by that.
Mm. Is the book available in Britain?
Mm. Yeah, Britain and Ireland. It's been serialized on Irish radio and been selling very
Great.
Well in Britain. Very, very well.
Very, very good. Mm. Our guest this afternoon, Cole Morton, we're talking with him about his book, Hungry for Home, Leaving the Blaskets, A Journey from the Edge of Ireland. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite your telephone calls this afternoon. Questions, comments are encouraged in Champaign-Urbana. The number 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else you're listening, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Back to the idea of what life was like 50, 60 years ago, maybe we could also talk about what it was like earlier, but you write even into the middle of the 20th century, the people of the Great Blasket lived a life that could be described as medieval. Maybe you'd give us some sense of what day-to-day life was like, perhaps summertime and wintertime.
Well, the first thing to understand is the geography. We're talking about an island that, as somebody said, looks like a humpbacked whale. And the village was built on one slope. If you can imagine a long sort of funnel shape with a slope on, at the end that isn't tapered, if you like. And then there was a very small space of about half a mile, maybe three quarters of a mile, which was very steep angle indeed, like the side of a mountain, into which, built into the earth, if you like, were many stone cottages, a village that at one point could hold 150 people. People living in houses built with dry stone from the fields and with tarred or felt roofs. Very, very often, families of 10 or 12 to one or two rooms, and very often sharing some of that living space with animals as well. They weren't great farmers. Every family had perhaps a cow or a pig, some dogs, some chickens. And there was a common space of land on the side. Again, let me stress, this is the side of a mountain we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
It's not pastoral and wonderful. It's a steep slope where you get 80, 90, 100 mile-an-hour winds in the middle of summer even. And there on the side of the mountain, they grew some crops. But the men were essentially fishermen. And what we have to understand there was that the Blasket Sound, the stretch of water between themselves and the mainland, although it's only a mile, mile and a half as the crow flies, is one of the most treacherous pieces of sea in Europe. Under that stretch of water, 30 plus different shipwrecks, including an enormous Spanish galleon. And so for the men to go out fishing in small canoes, each carrying three or four people, on big waves, was a perilous business. And add to that the fact that they lived in conditions in the winter that were often very, very wet, very muddy, treacherous underfoot from frost. And living on the side of a cliff there, and then getting into a boat, there was the death was present at all times. You know,
mm-hmm.
It was always there. And in the winter, you could find yourself, as people do at the beginning of the book, cut off from the outside world for a month, 2 months, maybe longer. The fog would come in and would actually remove the vision of the rest of Ireland. You couldn't see beyond the fog. You'd think you were on your own. The sea would be unpassable. There'd be no way out. And right up until the end, there was no adequate radio communication with the mainland, so there was no way of getting in touch with people there. So in the winter, very much a siege mentality. And even towards the end, in 1951, 52, even while they were asking the Irish government to have them to help them get off the island, people on that island were living on potatoes and salt and nothing else all winter.
Mm.
So siege mentality then. And then the spring comes, and it's the most beautiful place on earth. Absolutely spectacular. You can see, as you look out on the side of the mountain, which is in bloom, of course, everything is green and lovely, very, very warm on a summer's day. You can see islands stretching out before you and the Atlantic behind you. You could see the horizon shimmering. They had in their mythology a place called the Land of Youth, which was away to the west beyond the islands. And you can see where that idea comes from, because you see the horizon shimmering gold on a summer's day. Really the most unspoiled, spectacular place. A National Geographic traveler called it the most beautiful place on earth. And on the right day, on the right summer's day, you can understand why.
Mm. Might the island be inhabited again?
Well, there are people who go there in the summer. There are people who live there for, I don't know, 6 months of the year or something. One or two people who try to make a living from visitors. I mean, there is a ferry service. It's very, very difficult to get in because the sea remains treacherous, and even with state-of-the-art boats, it's very difficult to get across often. But there are a handful of people who camp or are looking to build the place up. It has been the subject of a big legal dispute, actually. The Irish government wanted to make it a national park. Unfortunately, some of the land was in the hands of an American millionaire, actually, first, but then a solicitor, an Irish solicitor, who bought the land from him. And there is still some dispute over who owns what and whether the government has a right to make it a national park. So ultimately, I think the government would like to see it protected and preserved, essentially as a monument to the culture that has been there before, whereas there are others who would like to see a hostel there, a hotel there maybe, and people going back to live there. It's very much a bone of contention in Ireland at the moment.
Hmm. Let's talk with a listener, a caller on line one in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, I'm enjoying your description of your book and the island very much. This is a little bit of a tangent, but I was reminded of something a friend had told me when you mentioned the Spanish Armada. Mm. I had a friend who was married to a man whose last name was Spanish, but had the O apostrophe in front of it. And she told us that he was descended from survivors of the battle of the Spanish Armada and the English Navy, who had washed up on the shores of Ireland, and some of them, of course, had gone back to Spain, but some of them had taken root there and adopted the Irish O apostrophe. I'd always assumed it was on the eastern side of the island and not the western side.
No, very much the west.
Pardon?
It's very much the western side.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
what's,
wow.
What's your name, by the way?
My name? Oh,
yeah.
Oh, or his name.
No, your name.
Oh, my name is Cindy.
Oh, right. Hi, Cindy. I just want to know who I'm talking to.
Okay. Thank you. yeah, I thought that was fascinating. I mean, it's just so interesting to, you know, the way people come together.
Well, look, let me, shall I just sketch out a little bit of how that might have happened?
Sure.
It's actually quite familiar to me, that. What really happened was that when they knew they were beaten, the Spanish Armada fled from the English Channel up along the eastern side, as you say, along the eastern side of Britain, and around Scotland, with the hope of making their way back along the western coast of Ireland, and then down to Spain. The trouble is that by the time they got to the western coast of Ireland, they were severely depleted already, because obviously the injuries of battle, but also they'd been at sea a long time and their supplies had begun to run out, and then there was an almighty storm. And there were terrible, terrible storms that blew many of the Armada surviving galleons into the west coast of Ireland to different ports all the way down. And in our own little bit of the place that we're talking about now, there's a narrow reef by the Great Blasket and where there's a 100-yard gap through some of the most treacherous waters, as I've said. Mm. And there is a story of a Spanish Armada captain who sailed what was at that time the biggest ship in the world, through that 100-meter gap, in the middle of a storm at full speed, in order to get to shelter that he knew was on the other side, and was successful. And so there are those stories all the way down the western coast of Spanish survivors, their ships being wrecked and them being washed up and being taken in. And it's actually quite familiar. I have a number of friends. One particular comes to mind who has black hair like a Spaniard and sort of, you know, kind of burning black eyes, really. And mm-hmm. his name is Moore, de Moore, as they say in Irish.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. But Moore also alluding to the Spanish, obviously. And his family's been there for 500 years at least.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of it about.
Yeah. Well, I'm really glad I called and got more details about it. I'd always been interested in that story that my friend had told me about their last name.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there's a book. I can't remember the name of the author, but there's a book called Full Fathom Five, which tells you about what happened to the Armada. I'd recommend you have a look at that.
Oh, okay. Full Fathom Five.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, and I was going to mention, too, what you mentioned about them the shipwreck survivors being taken in. And I remember my friend had talked about how, you know, the survivors from the Armada were welcome in Ireland because of their own feelings against the English and happy to take in the enemies of the English.
Yeah, well, and also the religious aspect comes in. In the Donegal Peninsula, the reason why the Armada captain was able to sail that boat through that narrow gap, the reason he knew it was there was because 8 years earlier than that, he had been in charge of a vessel that dropped off 700 Spanish and Italian Catholic mercenaries to fight against the forces of Queen Elizabeth. On the Dingle Peninsula, and in fact they were all slaughtered by Sir Walter Raleigh, which is something I was never taught in school when I was taught about Sir Walter Raleigh.
Right.
So the religious aspect of it was also quite strong, really.
Right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for calling, Cindy.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other calls are welcome. Questions and comments encouraged. 333-WILL, the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Cole Morton, our guest this afternoon. He's the author of Hungry for Home, Leaving the Blaskets, A Journey from the Edge of Ireland. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Before too much time goes past us here this afternoon, Cole, I think we should talk definitely about Kate Kearney. Her mother died when she was a young girl, and she became mother to her 7 brothers and a sister. Remarkable woman.
She was. She is.
She is.
Yeah. I saw her very recently. She was, as you say, very, very young. And was in charge of an unruly household, let's put it that way. I know those boys, and I'm sure they won't mind me saying, if they're listening, that they were a handful. But Kate was the woman who held them all together and who saw them, had to hold the family together in the hardest of times. The reason why I focus on Kate and the family was that the death of one of the boys, Seanine, who was 24, was actually the catalyst for the end, for the reason that people got off. He was taken ill on Christmas Eve and died of meningitis some time later, his family having had to watch him slowly fade away in the middle of winter, cut off from the outside world, in that siege mentality that I mentioned before. And Kate had to nurse him and to be with him when he died. And in the book, I describe what a wake would have been like on the island and how it would have been to mourn the dead while they were in the room. And then Kate came to the Irish mainland, where she still lives, not quite within sight of the island, but near enough. And all of her brothers and her sister all emigrated to America.
She's been to the U.S. a couple of times, but didn't like it. Good for her.
Yeah, the Blasket Islanders are a bit like that. Given that almost all the entire Blasket community relocated itself to the same half dozen streets of a Massachusetts town, there are also those who have been to visit and said, "No, we'll stick with our old ways, thank you." And if you visit their homes, you are effectively visiting a home that could be existing any time in the last 200 years.
Hmm. And back to the idea of those shipwrecks, you visit with a couple of brothers who have china recovered from wrecks.
They do. Some doubt between them as to whether they the authenticity of it all. In the end, a story is a good story. You know, it doesn't really matter. But there was talk, and I saw it, of them having a teacup from the Lusitania, the wreck of the Lusitania, which had been washed up in a tea chest a long way around the coast, yeah. But as I say, they're never short of a good story.
Mm.
For me, really, the fascinating thing was to be with those people who will only speak Irish. It's their language. And at the end of the Dingle Peninsula, most people speak Irish as their first language. To be in their homes, to be well received in their homes. Sean and Maurice Cahean, the brothers you're talking of, had no electricity, no modern amenities. Their house was as it had been on the Great Blasket. And then to go from them to their brothers and sisters in America to make that journey and find something very, very different in Springfield, Massachusetts.
Shanine died in 1947, and as you mentioned, it was horrible. Died without a doctor and without a priest, and the people on the island were unable to get in touch with folks on the mainland because the telephone, if you will, which was just a device for sending Morse code, correct?
Yeah.
Was not working.
No. Well, so. I mean, the Irish government in its wisdom had decided that it was best powered by wind generators. For Blizz, the winds were 120 miles an hour, so every time they put it out up there, the engineers left the island and the wind smashed it to bits the next day, and it took 6 months for the engineers to come back and repair it again. And that went on for years.
Yeah.
So it was barely in operation at all.
And so the islanders, in a way, they had about had it with the government.
Yeah. I mean, they sent a series of increasingly desperate telegrams to Eamon de Valera, who, because of his part in the Irish Revolution, had become a heroic figure, really, and who had visited the island during the worst times. And he came back to visit them in great pomp and ceremony as the leader of Ireland, and promised them that because they were the keepers of a cultural flame, because they were the people who kept the language and the way of life together, that he would do all he could to protect them. And then, as far as anyone can tell, he then went back to Dublin and wrote a note that said if they die off, then so much the better for it, really. And he failed to live up to his public promise to them. Mm. And in fact, it was 5 years between his visit in great ceremony and the final miserable day when the last of the families were taken off.
What did the islanders want from de Valera and the Irish government?
Well, about that time, there were other islands that were being helped. There were two schools of thought, really. One said that if you could invest enough in a proper landing place and proper communications with the outside world, it would be possible to keep the island going and actually to stop the young people leaving. Because by this time, what had become a great problem was that the population was aging. There were only 22 people left at the end, and the young people had one by one emigrated to America. So the idea was that if you put up a proper jetty and had a proper telephone and encouraged industry on the island, then you could make it work. That was one school of thought. Another said that the islanders, because of all they'd been through, should be relocated on the island within sight. Relocated on the mainland within sight of the island and retain the rights to graze their sheep there, which is what happened in the end. But by the time that help came through, almost all of the families had given up hope and made their own arrangements. So only a bare few ended up with homes on the Irish mainland.
Do you think the Irish government sort of made them wait it out and that was on purpose, or was that just the way the bureaucracy and worked?
It's the way all governments work, isn't it, that they wait for problems to disappear. There was a change of government. De Valera lost his position and then got it back again. But also, there was a real problem in the attitude of civil servants in Ireland, in Dublin, particularly towards people that they perceived as being savages, really, not much more. And their attitude was, well, we could never give them anything to do because we couldn't trust them with the money, and they've never paid us taxes anyway, so why don't we just disperse them, and so much the better for it. And there is a genuine rage, I think, still, after all this time, and of all the places in the world that carry history and the present together at the same time, the West of Ireland is one of them. There is still a genuine rage among ex-islanders and people who live at the end of the Dingle Peninsula that the Irish government didn't do more and that the community wasn't saved. Mm. Because in the end, you know, it is a story of significance and significance to the culture of Ireland. And these people were put on a pedestal as idealized Irish people. But as I tried to bring out in the book, the individual stories of what happened to those people are heartbreaking.
Yeah, it's so heartbreaking. You know, on the one hand, they're being held up as a symbol of the old and of the new Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, and yet the Republic turns its back on them.
Yes, it did. And, you know, actually what then happened, having done that, the fame of the books passed away. People were made to learn particularly Peg Sayers' autobiography at school. So by the time I came to pick up this story again, there was a genuine feeling that people were sick of the Blaskets. You know, they'd had enough of it. That was a very old story. And anyway, they'd all been forced to read Peg when they were at school, and they wanted no more to do with it. And that has nothing to do with the modern Ireland. And what's been really interesting is the way that people have, in Ireland particularly, and in America, have responded to what I've tried to do, which is bring out a dimension of the story they didn't know. Most people who say, among the Irish diaspora, that they know the Blaskets, will not know what happened in the end, and will not know quite the reality of this extraordinary community, who were as mischievous and sexually adventurous as any other community of 150 people in the middle of nowhere, with no priest, no doctor, and no policeman, and who were also extraordinary storytellers and amazingly resourceful to reinvent themselves on the other side of the world.
Yeah. How have the descendants in Springfield, Massachusetts, fared?
Tremendously well. In the 50s, you could walk down half dozen streets in Springfield and everybody would be first or second Blasket Islander and be speaking Gaelic. Nowadays, what has essentially happened was that the first generation immigrants went there, worked three jobs, like every other immigrant community really, worked three jobs, worked tremendously hard for their children to assimilate. The children became all American, in many cases weren't taught Irish at all, and became tremendously successful, and as a result, they moved away from the ghetto, if you like, from the Blaskett ghetto in Springfield, and went to do wonderful jobs. For example, Kate's niece there is an oceanographer in Cape Cod. What a tremendous change of life that is in just two generations.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next generation, the grandchildren of those original settlers, have begun to say, where is it that we come from?
Mm-hmm.
Let's go back and trace and see where we are. They've begun to learn Irish, and they've begun to look around and see where they come from. So what you have really in Springfield is a tight Blaskett community which split up because of its own success, and now gradually all around the place people are beginning to rediscover where it was that they came from. It's a classic story really in terms of immigration, and from what I gather from people who've written to me from around America, it's actually a story that has parallels in a number of other immigrant communities.
Mm-hmm. It's that first generation gets right down to the business of surviving in their new home, and then their children strive so much to fit in, and then it's the grandchildren who say, wait a minute, where did we come from?
Sure.
Yeah. We're here at the end of the time we can spend together today. It's been a pleasure both reading your book and talking with you this afternoon.
My pleasure too. Thank you very much.
Cole Morton, thank you very much. Hungry for Home, Leaving the Blaskets, A Journey from the Edge of Ireland is published by Viking. And Cole spells his name MOREETON. Cole Morton, Hungry for Home.